So, my talk this morning is about a model that I created during my dissertation work to look at linkage to care for people with HIV. And I don't have any disclosures. I think most everybody is familiar with the cascade. I think you can intervene at any one of these points. It's much needed. I chose linkage to care because I'm a public health nurse. And as a nurse, I'm more involved in the care side, but as a public health nurse, it also shows me the prevention side, and I see linkage to care as being the bridge between those two. When treatment as prevention came out, it gave us a new tool in the toolkit to prevent the spread. It won't work if we can't get people into care. So, there's been a lot of research that's been done in larger areas, but I was in a smaller metropolitan, largely rural area in Florida, and they couldn't afford some of the interventions that were out there. So I had a community-engaged approach, and we sought to determine what people take into consideration when they're deciding whether to link to care, and what can we as providers do to facilitate that process. Reviewed a lot of literature, and what seemed to be really important in the literature to aid transitions in care was coordination, continuity, advocacy, outcomes, quality, and cost. Used a social ecological model and grounded theory methods. I'm not going to bore you too much with that. It was IRB approved. My participants were over 18 and HIV positive. There were no exclusion criteria. It's purpose of sampling. And the setting was North Central Florida, and I recruited from county health departments. We have a facility at University of Florida called Health Street, which bridges the community and research, and local HIV/AIDS advocacy groups. I did individual interviews. They lasted about an hour, and I focused my questions on experiences at diagnosis, their decision to link to care, and recommendations, and people who participated in the study had a $25 gift card. My sample was roughly equal, male, female, mainly older than 35, mostly Black or African American, mostly not Hispanic, and most everyone had at least a high school diploma or beyond. And so here we get to the model, and I'm going to spend the next few minutes really focusing on each of the concepts that I identified from the data that went into the development of the model. And I'm going to start with stigma. And stigma is what really provides the context to the problem of linkage to care. If stigma didn't exist, I don't think the problem with linkage would exist. It's really compounded in smaller metropolitan and rural areas. One of my participants told me that they're scared to go to the health department because people that work there that know everybody, it's like everybody knows everybody, where they work, and basically they may even tell you who's sleeping with who. My participants identify conditions that would influence their decision to get into care. This is how we define care. How we as a provider may define care could be very different. We see it as a lab visit. We see it as coming to the provider, the HIV provider. They may see going to their chiropractor as being in care. So we really need to understand how our participants define care. How people are engaged in care was another influential thing. Is it something that they were mandated to do because they were pregnant? Is it something that they had a family member that was really involved with them that helped influence that process? Or were they in jail and there was a jail program there? And the third condition that influenced that decision was receiving conflicting messages of care. Of one participant who went to the provider because that's what he thought he was supposed to do. And in his first visit, he said, "Everything's with you. Is clear, you're not low enough to even start taking medication right now, so basically there's nothing that we can do for you." And he never went back because he heard that nothing we can do for you, as I don't need to be in care. As the provider, there's nothing we can do for you, meant we're not going to start you on meds. So he'd be clear in that in those conversations. There was one other condition that people talked about, but they didn't talk about it just as far as influencing their decision. They talked about it as being really necessary throughout the entire process, and I think support. And it's obvious, people need support. But what struck me was the different types of support people talked about needing during the process. And what they said was, we don't need cognitive support when we're diagnosed. We need emotional support. When you've been diagnosed, I know how it was for me when I found out. I was more concerned with my life, how I was going to deal with this, how I was going to tell my family, how I was going to tell my friends, how my family was going to accept me now, and how I'm going to live with it. They didn't want teaching about what they needed to be doing. So the blue is the process, and now I'm going to go through each of the blue points in the next few slides. And we're going to begin at diagnosis. What people told me at diagnosis was that they really needed guidance as to what to expect next. In the pediatric literature, we use this term anticipatory guidance to let people know what to expect at the next appointment, what they can expect developmentally in their children, what they can expect to see at home. And the other thing people said they needed was better delivery of a diagnosis. I think this is where how the providers, as you were saying, talk to people is very important. This man went to get his results, and the provider said, the person that just gave me the results was nasty and sent me on my way. His remark to me was, whatever behavior you were doing that got yourself into this trouble, you need to stop that now. Everyone talked about a crisis or a grief response after diagnosis. And why this surprised me was because there were many people in my sample who knew they probably were infected because their partners were infected, but they still experienced this crisis or grief response. They said they needed someone from the healthcare system to maintain a connection during that crisis period. And that crisis period could be a day, a month, a year, but they needed that connection. They said they needed help learning to navigate the system, and they said they needed counseling. Brings us to the decision point. The decision was not always a choice. As I talked about before, there were things that influenced the decision as defining care, engaging care, conflicting messages of care. But what they said helped them was coming to terms. One participant described it, compared it to a 12-step program. As soon as you can come to terms with the diagnosis, then you're able to move on. And if not, you would end up here and delaying or, just going to care intermittently. People who delayed care, they talked about stigma. They talked about access, substance use, mental health, many, many things that we know are barriers to treatment. Competing life stressors was another one. HIV was the least of their worries. I asked them what moved them out of this delay, and they would describe a pivotal event, a spiritual awakening, a drug charge, going to jail, going to a mental institution, a divorce. Something happened in their lives that would lead them back up to this reappraisal of their life. The goal of the model was getting into HIV care. People said to stay in HIV care. And it's interesting, when you talk to people about linkage to care, they talk about being in care. You talk to people about being in care, they'll talk to you about how they got into care. And I realized there's not a good separation there. And they said, in order for people to stay in care, we need a holistic understanding and we need shared decision-making with our providers. And they also said, as I took the model back to my participants throughout, I didn't have the arrow between care and pivotal events. And I said, you know, just because I'm in care doesn't mean I'm going to stay in care. There could be something that happens in my life that puts me back into that delay of care. But I think one of the most important quotes that I discovered in my data was about holistic care. I said, Cassie, the healthcare system needs to try and put a human face on the person that they're working with. I'm a hairdresser. And if you're getting married, I can't just talk to you on the phone and figure out what you're going to do. I'm going to actually have to put a human face to you to figure out what hairstyle is going to look good, what color is going to look good. You can't just sit me in an office, tell me I got to do this, and I got to do that, and all right, next, done, because then I'm a guinea pig, or I'm an object that you're working on, and I'm not human. And so, the model is complete. What does it all mean? In public health, we are focusing on people knowing their status, early diagnosis and treatment, test and treat. Treatment is prevention. 96% chance of decreasing transmission. But what I realized in looking at my data that how we practice as a system doesn't always equal what our patients need. And I'm going to talk about it in the areas of support, diagnosis, and client-centered care. As providers, sometimes we forget the impact of an HIV diagnosis. 5 minutes? Oh, I'm good. We think when we see them in the office, that might be the only time we get to see them, that they may not come back, and feel that we need to teach them as much as we can about the disease. They're in a crisis. They can't hear this at this point. This is what they hear. What they need is emotional support. They need to know that they can be connected. They want to know how they can tell their partner how it's going to feel when they get up in the morning. They want to know that they're still going to be loved. And people feel that that was best done by someone who had HIV because they knew what it was like. And they said, you know, even though you're real nice, you still won't know what it's like. So I'm going to talk about diagnosis and what our goals are when we, in public health, when we give someone a diagnosis. We want them to know their status. We think that if they know their status, they'll go into care. We want to get them in treatment because treatment is prevention. We want to know who their partners are, partner notification map. But is that taking into consideration what their goals may be? And we need to ask them what their goals are at diagnosis instead of after they've not linked to care. We need to make sure that we have quality in how people are delivering a diagnosis. And this is where these provider trainings are going to come in really well, because people who are outside of working in HIV may not know the best way. And recently, I was working in Ocala, Florida, and one of the patients was told to call hospice at diagnosis. It's scary. So we need to provide anticipatory guidance and let people know what their feelings, expectations, that there's going to be somebody from the health department that's going to come, and they're going to ask you a lot of questions about who you've been sleeping with. You know, don't surprise them. And we need to make sure we take a holistic view of people. And I think you touched on this in, you know, that client-centered care. Understand the meaning, what is happening in people's lives, the context, what's going on, what are their goals. Make those decisions together. Be compassionate and realistic. I think we don't need to wait until someone has failed to get into care to begin this patient-centered approach or client-centered approach. I think we need to do that right at diagnosis and make sure that everyone trained in delivering an HIV diagnosis is also trained in client-centered care. And I think instead of this focus on treatment as prevention, and if you're not taking your meds, you don't come back to clinic till you're ready to take your meds, let's go look at it as care as prevention. Because there's a lot of things we can do in healthcare that can move people towards health. But if they are coming then when they're ready to be on treatment, then we can do it. But if they don't come, that's not going to happen. So I allow a lot of people to think, and I guess we can start on questions.
As policy implementation in the program as well, it's a very generic document. It's not specific to any country, but the last section of it is actually things you should consider as you adapt to your particular setting. So yeah, it's online, and there's both the toolkit itself, but also a trainer's manual as well. Yeah, so it can be used anywhere. So it's developed with U.S. government resources, so free to anybody to use.
I have a question for Michael. Is there any talk of actually doing certification for, I have an MBA, and I've been working in HIV for almost 30 years,
yep.
And I feel like I want to be certified. And I think sometimes I don't want to educate MDs,
yep.
And I'm not.
Absolutely.
So I wish that there would be some sort of certification for that. Maybe after you finish with the primary care position and I get all that, maybe you should think about that.
Well, that's an excellent point. And it's something that we have thought about considerably, taking this model and replicating it into other fields of practice. And actually on Monday, we are launching an ASO-CBO leadership initiative online, which follows a very similar kind of style, 5 modules, which really gives an overview of the fundamentals of what's happening in the environment now and how to think about change and change management within organizations. So that's something that's being launched. We're going to pilot it, see what happens. But as the conference, as you attended the opening session, leadership development is so critical and making sure that people get credit and certification in areas that are absolutely essential.
And I was happy to pass that along. Ready to move to publication. So, last week, so hopefully within the next couple of months.
Thank you.
country that we looked at, they had their pockets of innovation. The challenge is that nothing's going to scale. There's lots of little innovative programs. It works well in the capital city. It works well in a rural community. There's no strategy in most of the countries of now how do you take it to scale and how do you reach more than 100 girls here, a community of 50 boys here. There are some innovative activities, say in prevention, they're looking at cash transfers to keep girls at school because we know that girls who make it through school are much less likely to engage in risky behaviors. They delay sexual debut. But that is a costly intervention, paying, and there are people who have ethical concerns about paying girls to stay in school. There are lots of innovative and good methods, innovative programs being shown around training adolescents living with HIV to be peer outreach. It's same things that we know for adults. It's nothing necessarily rocket science, but it's taking it to scale and giving agency to youth to do this and giving them a setting to do this. And there's a fair amount that's being shown about engaging parents and caregivers to be support to their children, particularly adolescents living with HIV to transition. But the big challenge is to take all of these little successful little programs that have 100 people or 150 in them, and how do you resource them to take them?
Would be really important as well to have that mentorship there in place. Have I answered your question?
So you're saying that there should be follow up to the original diagnosis, or you're saying all this information should be put into that one session? Because some people don't know that, and you only have that one opportunity to talk to them.
Right, and it's a challenge. And so, and in this, do we get into how our system works where, you know, you have your one session and the person may be visited by a disease intervention specialist and then we hope that they go to care. Are they keyed up with a peer navigator? What are the resources? You know, ARDIS is expensive and prohibitive in a small rural county. And so how can we structure what we're doing? You know, is it as simple as a phone call, just keeping people up? I worked in a study as a public health nurse, and the goal for us was just getting people from a temporary assistance for needy families office, just getting them hooked up with a provider, identifying what their needs were when they came into the office, not after they got sick. So that's another area I think we could explore is, you know, if somebody comes and they're getting an HIV diagnosis, what are the other competing life stressors that are going on in their lives that we know are going to possibly prevent them from moving into care? And can we begin to address those? And they're huge system issues and how to pay for it. And, you know, and as our healthcare system is changing and more people are gaining access to care, we may be able to address some of those in a different way.
Yeah, and I think the challenge, whether it's here in the United States or in, I have the luxury of working both in the United States and overseas, what we do, a lousy job is addressing the structural barriers that keep the people out of care. We can talk.
We think we know what to do, but we don't.
We give lip service to that. We acknowledge that they're present, but whether we can actually deal with them is a whole other matter. And we don't spend enough time truly having the services in place and spending the time to truly spend the time to how to address those. And to your point as well, having been at the end of the receiving end of that result and getting bombarded with everything that is going to take place over my lifetime of living with HIV, that is not helpful. What I need to know is what's going to happen in the next 30 to 45 days. I'm just speaking from my experience. I know the provider's trying to be helpful and trying to tell me what I need to think about forever, but I've got to deal with, as you were saying, disclosure, I've got a job I have to do, I have this and that, and I've just gotten faced with this, and it's still, for most of us, it is some level of death. The stigma of it being a death sentence still hangs over your head, and you've got to deal with that in the first 30 to 45 days, and that's what you're struggling with in that first 30 to 45 days. That's what you've got to get through and pass to get people to hook to come back into that next follow-up visit.
Giving them the emotional support. My mentor one time pointed out to me that, you know, as a system, we're focused on everybody, and sometimes when we don't focus on the person and what they need, they don't feel valued and they don't feel like coming back. We don't make that connection when they walk in the door, and try to make that connection when they walk in the door so they will come back.
And that starts everybody from the person who takes the receptionist from the minute you walk in the door to the last person you see on the way out the door. And anybody can upset that apple cart at any point in time through the process.
So everybody in the whole process needs training and client or person-centered care. No matter what you do to get them to come back, the next person they see, if they don't have that same focus, all your work.
I would just also, I totally agree with all that they said, but there is a true fundamental problem when someone tests for HIV and we encourage them to access care, and the closest time they can get an appointment with a doctor who can provide those services sometimes is 4 months out. And how are we, what does that tell a client about their necessity to connect with care? Oh, I have to wait 4 months for this visit. Why, you know, it's not a big deal for me to access care. So that's a huge issue. There are models around the country that are being implemented in which the clinic or the providers have slots that are available throughout the course of their days, that when a new diagnosis happens, whether it's a non-clinical organization operating in the community or if it's testing within their clinical setting, the care team comes around that person and provides that initial introduction on, hi, I'm your doctor, I'm going to be treating you, I'm going to be talking with you about HIV, here's what we're going to do today, here's the social worker, here's the peer advocate and educator, here's the health navigator that can help you, and that is an opportunity to provide that person with additional support to really move forward.
Thank you.